Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Truth in Broadcasting.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on the 28th of December, Friday. We're on the air live here. If you're listening on Friday, I believe the show is going to be replayed on New Year's Day also, so happy New Year's Day to you. And it's going to be our Everything Anything Goes Friday. We'll also be playing some of our favorite clips, some of our most interesting audio of the year throughout the next couple of hours. But our first hour, as always on Friday, Senator Bernie Sanders. It's our brunch with Bernie, our Bernie Sanders, the independent from Vermont. I think of him as America's senator. He will be answering your questions at 866-303-2270. And Bernie's website and newsletter and everything is all available over at sanders.senate.gov. Bernie, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, Happy Hanukkah, all that stuff. Happy holidays.
But same to you, Tom, and same to the listeners. And let's hope everybody has a healthy new year and that, in fact, next year becomes, from a political perspective, a better year than this was.
Yeah, from your lips to God's ears. I'm curious about your thoughts on the assassination yesterday of Benazir Bhutto.
Well, obviously it is a tragedy, and I know I speak for all the people in Vermont and all Americans in expressing our condolences to the people of Pakistan. She clearly had her political problems, but she showed an enormous amount of courage by continuing to campaign within the democratic framework of Pakistan, putting a life at risk. You know, here's a person who was almost assassinated a couple of months ago. She kept going, and yesterday she was killed. I mean, it speaks beyond Pakistan to our policies in which we continue to have 140,000, 150,000 troops bogged down in Iraq. We're spending $12 billion a month fighting that war, and yet we have not paid the kind of attention we should be paying to Pakistan, which is, from a geopolitical point of view, a much more significant gain for al-Qaeda than Iraq would ever be. We're losing ground in Afghanistan, a very significant struggle taking place there. And it speaks to the fact that we need a new policy to fight international terrorism and al-Qaeda. And Bush is, on this issue, is on so many others, leading us in the wrong direction.
Yeah, and it seems to this person, I'm not a politician, I'm not in the midst of it, and I certainly don't have the security clearance or information and insights that you do, but it seems to me that one of the most effective ways to, you know, quote, fight terrorism, end quote, would be to win the minds and hearts of people, and you do that by helping them around the world, not bombing them.
No, that's exactly right. It is so hard to think about how we can win this struggle when America's standing in the world now is probably lower than it has ever been in the history of our country. And what we have got, and it's a tough, you know, when you have, you know, fanaticism, people there who think they're going to go to heaven by blowing up innocent people, that's tough stuff. And that, no matter who the president is. But clearly our position, our face to the world has got to be one where we stand for the poor people of the world in making sure that their kids have health care and are not dying from curable diseases, where their kids have education, where we are spending our money trying to uplift people rather than provide the kinds of weaponry and bombs and warlike gestures that we've been doing for so many years. So I think we really need a new face. It's tough stuff, but clearly what Bush is doing has been counterproductive in many ways. I mean, you're looking, after all of the money, after all of the death, al-Qaeda today is in many ways stronger than it was years ago, and that just speaks to the failure of Bush's approach.
Yeah, oh, amen. Very well said. What's on your schedule
today? Well, let
me just
say a few things, being that we're at the end of the year. Let me just talk a little bit about what has been going on in Congress over the years, some of the highlights, and some, obviously, of the real gaps in areas that we have not made much progress. I think the Democratic leadership there deserves some credit for making progress on some issues. Finally, after years of inaction, the minimum wage was raised from $5.15 an hour to $7.25 an hour over 3 years, paying attention to some of the most desperate people in this country who work 40 hours a week and fall further and further behind. That's not insignificant. We have passed the largest increase in funding for our veterans in the history of the Veterans Administration, which, if the VA is properly managed, and that's a big if, by the way, should help improve health care for older veterans as well as those returning from Iraq and Afghanistan, begin to deal with the problem, post-traumatic stress disorder, very serious problem, as well as traumatic brain injury. That's significant. We have made some progress, not enough by any means, but some progress in reversing Bush's disastrous. I mean, you know, in my view, as I've said many times on the show, Bush will go down in history, if not as the worst president in our country's history, certainly one of the worst. And where he's been even worse than in other areas has been the environment. Here's a president who has virtually ignored or refused to acknowledge global warming. I'm happy to say that the new Congress, both through an energy bill, which will raise CAFE standards and get increased mileage per gallon for our cars, plus other efforts to move us more toward biofuels, away from fossil fuels, move us more to energy efficiency, has made some progress in that area. Congress has passed Higher Education Reconciliation Act, which will go a long way, very significant bill in terms of making college and graduate school more affordable for middle-class families by significantly expanding Pell Grants, lowering interest rates for college loans, and providing debt forgiveness for those people who work in the public sector. So there have been some movements in the right direction. On the other hand, one has got to be very honest about acknowledging on many other areas, very little progress or no progress has been made. The middle class continues to shrink. Poverty continues to grow. We continue to have by far the most unequal distribution of wealth and income. The gap between the rich and the poor is growing wider and wider. Congress has made no progress in addressing that issue. Clearly, the war in Iraq continues. As I mentioned earlier, $12 billion a month. You know, some of the listeners may have read or seen the president talking about, oh, my goodness, he can't support the big spending efforts of the Congress, and he's got to veto this, and he's got to veto children's health insurance and all this stuff. All of that was, if my memory is correct, was about $22 billion. That was the big difference. Meanwhile, $12 billion a month in Iraq. 2 months in Iraq is the whole difference between what Congress wanted and what the president wanted. And I, of course, think Congress was very, very conservative in not spending the kind of money we need to address so many long-neglected programs, whether it's the needs, whether it's health care, whether it is child care and the needs of our kids in general and so forth and so on. So I would give, you know, the Congress a mixed grade. I think some progress has been made. A lot has not been done. And I think as we come back, we're on break now, and we'll come back in late January, I think the word has got to come down from the Democratic leadership that we are prepared to fight a lot more vigorously than we have in the past. I think what many listeners don't know is that in the Senate, it does not take 51 votes to win. It takes 60 votes to win, because what the Republicans have done in an unprecedented way, they have broken the all-time world's record in terms of filibusters. The old record, I think, was something like 59 or 60 for a two-year term. They now have 62 filibusters in a one-year, the first year. So they are way ahead in terms of filibustering important provisions, important legislations than we've ever seen before. And I think the response of the Democratic leadership has got to be, you want a filibuster? That's fine. But you know what? We're going to keep this place open 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. And if you want to talk about Iraq at 3 o'clock in the morning on a Sunday, we'll be there. And you want to talk about why you're not supporting an increase in funding for children's health care, we'll be there. And if you want to talk about why you want to maintain tax breaks for the oil companies rather than put that money into sustainable energy, we'll be there. So I think we have got to engage these guys and let the American people know that we're prepared to fight. And not so what has happened increasingly is a vote comes up, we get 55, 56 votes. We don't have enough for cloture at the end of the debate. And then we move on to something else.
This is going to require a Harry Reid to do it, though. Do you see any indication that that's going to happen?
Maybe. I mean, I think there are divisions. The problem with that, having said that, is it is painful. It's going to be painful for everybody, you know. Nobody wants, you know, people have wives, they have kids, they have obligations. I want to get back to Vermont on weekends. I always do. And if you'd ask 7 days a week, you can't do that. But I think that's the risk. That's what we have got to do. And I think we want to let the Republicans know that there will be pain if they filibuster.
Yeah. Well, good on you. Well said. Senator Bernie Sanders with us. He'll be taking your calls right after this break. 866-303-2270. It's the 28th, Friday the 28th of December. Stick around. We'll be right back. And welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And the Tom Hartman program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. Bernie, ready to pick up some phone calls?
Ready to go.
Okay, the lines are slammed here. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. Sheila in Eugene, Oregon, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Well, thank you. He already answered one of my comments, but I have another one. Bush has cut, I read in the paper, I guess it was the first of the month, that Bush has cut funding for our security. And also...
You still there, Sheila?
Pardon me?
Yep, we have lost Sheila. Let's try John in Tennessee. Hey, John.
Hello. Our trade practices...
I'm not hearing John.
Can you hear me now?
Okay, let me pot up my Comrex. John?
Can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Good. Our trade practices are incredibly unfair to America. Every time we lose one job, say of $26,000 a year, that's $6,000 that we lose in taxes. Also, China requires dual ownership when we put a company there. And the exports we're getting from China are really just our own companies sending stuff back to us and siphoning off the profit.
So, John, is there a question for Bernie in there?
Yes. What does he think he can do to help educate people about this unfair practice?
John, thank you very much. You've asked an excellent question. It's not a sexy question, but it is enormously important, and our disastrous trade policies are certainly one of the reasons why the middle class in America is declining, because despite a huge increase in worker productivity, we have millions of people who are working longer hours for low wages. We have in the last 6 years lost 3 million good-paying manufacturing jobs. Often those jobs are replaced by low-wage service industry jobs, and all of that, in my view, is related to such disastrous trade policies as permanent normal trade relations with China, NAFTA, CAFTA, et cetera, et cetera. As it happens, John, I have been one of the leaders, both in the House when I was there and now in the Senate, in opposition to these terrible trade policies. And you're right. What these corporations are doing is throwing American workers out on the street. They go to China. They pay people there 50 cents an hour, and they bring the products back into this country. I think we need to thoroughly re-examine our trade policies. I have voted against virtually every trade agreement that has come down the pike, including the recent one. But I have to tell you, the opposition from corporate America is enormous. It influences both political parties. We are trying to gather together the votes to stop some of these trade agreements. But it is tough. But certainly, if we're going to restore the middle class, we need to get manufacturing back in America and not simply let these companies run to China and bring their products into this country virtually duty-free.
Yeah, well said. Okay. Rich in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Bernie. How you doing, Tom?
Good.
Hey, in the Clinton administration, the Supreme Court cut the found the line item veto unconstitutional. The other day, the president signed the budget on Air Force One and added a signing statement saying that he might cut some of the budget. Isn't that a backdoor line item veto?
You got it. No, it's an outrageous statement. It is an outrageous statement. And I want you to know, Rich, that in my view, what this guy in the White House is trying to do really is provoke a major crisis, a major conflict with the Congress, which he thinks from a PR point of view he might be able to win to deflect attention from his disastrous policies and maybe help the Republican Party in the coming election. Here is a guy who is spending all kinds of money in the most horrific and absurd ways, and then says, well, I've got to cut back on this program, and we can't afford to do that, and I got to veto the S-CHIP program, and we can't spend more money on education, we can't do this. So to answer your question, if he does that, he will be provoking a major, major conflict with the Congress. He has signed the bill, and we expect it to be implemented.
It's interesting. Joan in New York, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hello.
Hi, Joan.
Hey, Joan.
Hello, Senator Sanders.
You're on the air.
Joan. Yeah.
Yes.
Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Oh, hello. Hi. I want to ask you a couple of questions about health care, my major issue. One is, what is going to be done about raising the Medicaid fees for doctors so we don't have any more situations like that young man in Washington, D.C. who died of an infected tooth? He went to his brain,
right,
and he died,
right,
because
right.
No doctor would see him. And the second question, is there a Senate companion bill to H.R. 676? And if not, will you introduce one?
What
is this, is the Medicare for All
Medicare
bill,
for
right?
All.
Medicare for All.
Okay. What Congress did, I believe, in the very last day, or last couple of days, is there was going to be a cut in reimbursement rates for doctors, which I think was done away with. In terms of dental situation, what I will tell you, Joan, is that in my state of Vermont and all over this country, this is a huge issue. We're working on very major pieces of legislation, A, to get more dentists in this country. We don't have enough dentists. Get them into rural areas, among other things, low-income areas. I think Tom would probably going to have to answer that one after the break.
And welcome back and Happy New Year, 9:34 on AM 620. Oh, boy. There I am back at the old radio station. 9:34 minutes past the hour here. Oh, man.
It's been a long year, Tom. Huh?
It's been a long year, Bernie. I'm looking forward to a four-day weekend here coming up.
You deserve it. Let me get back to Joan's question on health care.
Sure.
Bottom line here is that our health care system is disintegrating. We have 47 million uninsured, even more underinsured. The system is so in so much trouble right now, Tom, that I think Joan made mention of this. We can't even produce the kinds of doctors that we need, the number of doctors we need, especially in medically underserved areas, rural areas, urban areas. We can't produce the number of nurses we need. We certainly can't produce the number of dentists that we need. Joan asked me about Medicare for All, and I am in general supportive of that, although my preference is a single-payer system administered at the statewide level, and we've introduced legislation to encourage states to provide provide universal care. And the reason I took that approach is we're never going to get a Medicare for All bill passed the Senate right now. As you know, Bush even vetoed the effort to expand health insurance to 4 million more children. That was too radical for him. Mm-hmm. So we're certainly not going to get a universal care bill right now. The other area that we are working on is expanding what is called federally qualified health centers. We're doing that all over Vermont, and we got some money to do it all over the country, which will provide health care to all eligible people, all people, on a sliding scale basis, including dental care, low-cost prescription drugs, and mental health counseling. So that's kind of the emphasis we've been focused on right now with Bush in the White House and the limitations as to what we can do.
Sounds like a good first step. Frank in Middleton, New York. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hi. As you all know, Senator, over the last several years, the Republican legislators have certainly made it easier and easier and easier for the banks, the credit card companies, to pretty much drive an awful lot of people into irreversible debt. And at the same time, they've made changes to bankruptcy laws, unfortunately with the help of some Democrats, that make it now almost impossible for those people to ever get out from under that debt. Is there any chance that some of those draconian changes are going to be reversed in the next few years?
Well, Frank, you're right on both counts. The credit card companies are acting, in my view, criminally. They send out all of these pieces of mail, billions of pieces of mail, getting people to sign up, and people don't read the small print, which says that those zero interest rates or the 2% interest rates can be converted to 25 or 30% interest rates for any reason whatsoever. So this is really bait and switch. It is malicious and false advertising. I worked on that issue as a member of the Financial Services Committee in the House. So I think it is an issue that is being talked about. Unfortunately, the banks and the credit card companies are very, very powerful and have sway over members of both political parties. But it is an issue that is increasingly being talked about. My own view is that we have to go back to usury standards, and we have to say that if somebody is paying 25 or 28% on interest, that is usury, and that should not be allowed in the United States of America, not to mention false advertising and everything else. And Frank also talks about this bankruptcy bill, which was a very, very bad bill, and he's quite right. People who are deeply in debt are never going to get out of that debt, and I do think we should revisit that issue as well.
David in Columbus, Ohio, we're Progressive Talk Radio, and our show is back on the air. David, welcome to the program.
Hi, thank you. I think Senator Sanders unfairly gets beaten up for Congress's lack of movement on doing anything to hold the president accountable for any of his domestic and international criminal activities. But frankly, impeachment is no longer an operative tool for government, given that the GOP pretty much effectively poisoned its use for all time. Given the path that Bush has been given, there's clearly no crime now for which impeachment will ever be considered again. However, charges of war crimes and crimes against humanity are independent of Congress, and charges of war crimes against humanity don't happen overnight. And we can take heart that people accused of these crimes, even 30 years after they were committed, are now being arrested. I mean, you know, we've got Alvarez was charged in December for his activities in Uruguay. Pinochet's ex-wife now has been arrested for complicity in his crimes. Isabel Perón, who was president.
David, I got it, and don't disagree. Is there a question for Senator Sanders in there?
Yeah, I guess the question is, given that, is there anything to prevent the investigative results of what investigations Congress is doing from being used for some type of future war crimes, or is there something that would prevent the results of those investigations from being used by, for example, the Hague?
Well, I'm not an expert on that issue, David, but I'm not sure that there's any type of investigation, any information that's coming out from an investigation that can't be used at any time. I'm not an expert on it, but that would be my guess.
I would guess the one caveat would be if with Ollie North, you know, he ultimately got off on the technicality because he'd been given immunity from prosecution in exchange for his testimony. If something like that happened, maybe. But with international tribunals, who knows? Doug in Denver, Colorado, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Happy New Year to the both of you.
Thank you.
And, Bernie, I hope I get to visit your state one of these days. I hear it's very beautiful.
It is
there.
Beautiful. We got a lot of snow. So
well, I hope to
I
make
know,
it
that's
there.
Nothing new for Colorado. But,
yeah, we got dumped on. Sir, this is a guarantee because I hear it from people. I have a lot of Republican friends. They're really, really angry. I really predict that we will take all three houses next year and by huge numbers. Now, given that, will we restore our Constitution and our laws and make our judicial system what it used to be? Can we achieve that if I am correct?
Well, you know, we don't want to count our chickens before they're hatched. And while I think there is an excellent chance that Democrats will add seats in the House and seats in the Senate, I think we got a fighting chance to win the White House. Believe me, it's going to take a lot of work to make sure that that happens. If that happens, and I will do everything in my power to make sure that it does happen, if that happens, we're going to have to lay down a very, very progressive agenda, certainly rolling back all of Bush's attacks, among many other things, in civil liberties. But I got to tell you, the next president of the United States is going to have just a huge challenge trying to undo all of the damage that Bush has done in terms of foreign affairs, our position internationally in the world, trying to get a handle on health care, reversing environmental problems, certainly dealing with the civil liberties issues that Doug talks about, et cetera. But what I can assure you, Doug, is just because the Democrats will have, we hope, the Senate, the House, and the White House, don't think that automatically good things are going to happen. We're going to need a very aggressive grassroots movement to put pressure on Democrats. There are a lot of Democrats who respond to corporate interests, just as Republicans do, and we're going to just need to have millions of people demanding fundamental changes in the direction of our country.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is Franklin Roosevelt couldn't have done what he had done if it wasn't for the American people being behind him.
That's right.
And pushing hard. Andre in South Carolina, you're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Hey, Tom. How you doing, Senator?
Good. Very good.
Okay. In light of the 2000 and 2004 presidential election fraud committed by the administration against the people, the first question is, without election reform, how can I trust my vote count?
Okay, Andre, stay on that one. It's a good and fair question, and I think is Tom Hartman has been one of the leaders in raising this issue for many, many years. And what we are seeing happening, whether it's Ohio or other states, is that people are now taking a very hard look at these touchscreen balloting process. And I think we want to continue that, and I would not lose any sleep if all of these touchscreen machines disappeared tomorrow and we went back to paper ballots. If it takes a little bit longer, let it take a little bit longer. I want the American people to be absolutely assured that their vote is accurately counted. Second of all, we don't want to become paranoid in the process. How do I know my vote's going to count? Well, you know what? In the last election, in 2006, there were three close U.S. Senate races. And the Republicans lost them all. So I don't want people, you know, to get paranoid and think that Karl Rove is going to press a button someplace and their votes are disappearing. That's not true. Having said that, we've got to be very, very vigilant, not only in terms of voting machines, but more importantly in the broad area of Republican efforts toward voter suppression. What they are trying to do with this so-called vote fraud, which is a much exaggerated problem, move to voter IDs, which will make it harder for poor people and old people to vote. They want to bring down the number of people who will be voting. They don't want poor people voting. They don't want minority people voting. And that's an issue we've got to focus on. We want a large voter turnout, and we want the votes accurately counted.
Well, and in fact, yesterday, Bernie, we had an email went out to Kansas Republicans from the head of the Kansas GOP bragging about the fact that they had caged thousands of voters. In other words, they had knocked off the voting rolls thousands of presumably Democratic voters in minority areas. The Republican Party's been operating under a court order banning them from caging since the 1980s, and they're bragging about doing it.
Right. Now, this is an outrage, and it's very clear. They've been public about this. If they could have a small voter turnout with the upper middle class voting, with wealthy people voting, with all of their wealthy friends providing the funds that candidates need, that's their idea of democracy. Our idea of democracy is to see the United States move forward to have very large voter turnouts, serious public discussion about the issues, and when that happens, our side is going to win and win big.
Yeah, okay.
I understand.
I'm sorry, I dropped you there. Let's see here. George in Van Nuys, California, just a follow-on question. We have about a half a minute.
They're caging in Kansas. What is the Attorney General doing about this situation?
Well, you know, I don't know what this Attorney General is doing, but obviously we know that the previous Attorney General was on the wrong side of virtually all of these issues, and that's the Bush administration. Congress has got to be absolutely vigorous to make sure that every American votes without intimidation, that we increase the voter turnout. We work toward election reforms, which make it easier for people to vote.
46 minutes past the hour.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old acquaintance be forgot and days of old lang syne?
And Happy New Year's to you. It's coming up soon here, and, And I believe this show will be rebroadcast on New Year's Day as well, so Happy New Year's Day to you. Tom Hartman program, 1-866-303-2270, our phone number, where it's our Brunch with Bernie segment. Senator Bernie Sanders with us, the independent from Vermont. His website, sanders.senate.gov. Our website, tomhartman.com. However you spell it, will get you there. And, Bernie, you were not in mid-thought, were you?
Right. I wanted to mention both, pick up on questions of Andre and George, and make a point here. And that is, there's a lot of concern around this country about making sure that every vote is accurately counted. I know, Tom, you and many of your listeners over the years were concerned about these touch screen machines, correct?
Yeah, and Rush Holt has a new piece of legislation out basically banning them. Just, you know,
but
let's
my point
paper.
Here is this is where grassroots activism plays a huge role. 3 or 4 years ago, Congress was not talking about this issue. Secretary of States were not talking about this issue. Now you have Secretary of States all over this country taking a hard look at this issue and in some cases now banning these machines. And this came from the grassroots. So getting back to a point I made a few minutes ago, I hope very much that you're going to have a Democrat in the White House and increase Democratic control in the House and the Senate. But even with that reality, we need to have strong grassroots activism on a dozen different issues to combat the extraordinary influence of big money on what goes on in Washington, no matter which party is in power.
Right. They throw money at it. We need to throw us at it.
That's right.
Stacy in Los Angeles listening on K-Talk. You're on the air with Senator Bernie Sanders.
Good morning. The Washington Post reported on Saturday that the Federal Election Commission, which is supposed to have 6 members, is down 2, and 2 are their terms expire on December 31st. There's been no effort to replace them. There won't be a quorum, which means that, for one, John Edwards will not get his over $8 million in matching funds, but there also won't be any money released to fund the national conventions. And apparently there's somebody whose name I can't remember except it starts with Von something, who's been, and he's sort of controversial, but Barack Obama is blocking his appointment, and I think it's solely to keep John Edwards from getting his money. But really what I want to know, Bernie, is A, do you know about this?
Yeah.
And B, what is
I don't know that that's, I know a little bit about it, not all that much. I'm not sure that your characterization is accurate. I think that one of the Republican nominees is apparently very, very controversial. And I think the Democratic leadership has asked the president to bring forth another name. He has refused, and that is what is stymieing the progress there.
Okay. Phil in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, you're on the air with Senator Bernie. Hey, Phil, tell me if my voice is louder now or if my voice is louder now.
It kind of sounds about the same to me, but I'm growing deaf, so I'm
okay. It's great to know it sounds the same on both sides.
You're going to be an engineer, sound engineer for the day, huh?
There you go. You're on the air, Phil.
I'm a filmmaker. I'm not a sound recorder. I just want to buttress what you said. I mean, the perception in the country has shifted so far to the right. I mean, my Republican friends and people in my family and what I call Metairie Republicans, I live in Louisiana, they can't put their minds around the magnitude of what's gone on, or to think that there's enough serious crimes to go for impeachment. I mean, they really do not see that. Our state legislature, Republicans, just ran Kathleen Blanco, our Democratic governor, out of office. She chose not to run at such a hard time in the legislature. She had a hard time with Katrina, of course, but the machine here, the Republican machine here in Louisiana, kicked in personal attacks, smearing her, and basically blocking any common sense legislation. I mean, they blocked, the Republicans in our legislature blocked pay raises for policemen and firemen so they could make her and other Democrats look bad. And that's what they're doing in the Senate right now.
That's exactly what they're doing in the Senate. What they understand is that when they were in power, they accomplished nothing, and the people threw them out. And what they have said is, hey, the major, and they're open about this, they're very open about it, our job now in the Senate, says the Republican leadership, is to make sure that nothing happens. And then we can go forward and say, see, what did the Democrats accomplish? And that is why they have brought forth a record number of filibusters, 62 filibusters. You name the important issue, we were required to get 60 votes, and that is pretty darn hard to do. And the American people have got to understand that.
Yeah, there's even an infamous quote from Trent Lott recently where he said something like, we're obstructing the votes and the Democrats are getting blamed for it. It's working out very well.
That is exactly right. Let's give credit to Trent Lott for being honest, because that is exactly what their intention is. And everybody in the Senate understands that.
Yeah. Joyce in Manhasset, New York. We have about a minute here before we've got to wrap up this hour, Joyce. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Joyce?
Oh, thank you. Excuse my voice. I have laryngitis. It's a great honor to be able to speak to both of you. Yesterday's New York Times had an article on the front page stating that the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission said Wednesday that employers could reduce or eliminate health benefits for retirees when they turn 65 and become eligible for Medicare. And this was a great concern to me. It states also that a lawyer for the AARP is stating that this is in direct conflict with the Age Discrimination in Employment Act.
Right. We got it, Joyce. Let's get Bernie's
response. Well, I think that is a very important issue. I bumped into that a lot in Vermont. But we should not be surprised about anything that the Bush administration does to help corporate America against the needs of working families or the elderly.
All the more reason for us to get politically active.
Right. Tom, let me just conclude by wishing everybody again a very happy holiday season. And a wonderful new year.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
And welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. The new year is upon us. Happy New Year's. We'll be taking, we'll be doing more or less our Anything Goes Friday throughout the next 2 hours here, 866-303-2270, our telephone number if you'd like to call in, if you'd like to drop by our live chat room or participate in our blog, tomhartman.com, will get you there. What's the deal with Ahmed Omar Saeed Sheikh? And how might this relate to what's going on in Pakistan? Let's remember that Pakistan is a country right now that after 60 years of so-called independence and democratic rule, although, you know, much of it has been military rule. Remember Zia, the guy, if you saw Charlie Wilson's War, the guy that they were negotiating with, the military strongman who did a coup against a democratically elected official before the current guy did, that Zia had hanged Benazir Bhutto's father, Ali Bhutto. And now we have Musharraf. Well, who knows? I mean, you know, it's the conspiracy theories never end, but Musharraf now apparently in the second week of January going to be elected prime minister or president, and this is going to give a patina of legitimacy to him. Imagine if in the United States in 2004, for example, you know, step into the Wayback Machine and go back to the 2004 election. Imagine if 2 weeks before the election, God forbid, John Kerry had been assassinated. And I say John Kerry rather than George Bush, because Bush is the guy in power. He's the guy who's president. And so here you have Musharraf, who's the guy in power, and the very popular leader who has actually a very good chance of beating Musharraf, Benazir Bhutto, is assassinated. So imagine if John Kerry had been assassinated 2 weeks before the elections. Would it not have been appropriate at that point in time for the president and Congress to get together and say, you know, the Democratic candidate, or in this case, actually, it would have to have been both John Kerry and John Edwards, because they ran together as a ticket, and Benazir Bhutto was running as a one-person ticket. So if both, you know, if the entire Democratic slate had been taken out, wouldn't it be appropriate to say, you know, the election's supposed to be in 2 weeks, but maybe we should wait a few weeks to give the Democrats time to reorganize themselves and put forward a candidate? Just something to think about. Along those same lines, back to Benazir Bhutto, here we have a country where in the 60 years since independence, you would think that it would have been run by more than just a kleptocracy. And this is one of the charges that has been made both against Ali Bhutto, against Benazir Bhutto's father, against her and her husband during the time that she was prime minister, and certainly against Zia and against Musharraf, is that basically they've been running the country as their own little fiefdoms, and they've been getting rich, and their buddies have been getting rich. But 50% of the population of Pakistan today is illiterate. 50%. And I would submit to you that one of the reasons why Pakistan has had so much turmoil and so much violence, and even though the vast majority of Pakistanis are in favor of a secular government, not a conservative Muslim government, one of the reasons there is such a strong movement in that country is because of that, is because poverty and illiteracy are so widespread in that country. Now, before Benazir Bhutto was assassinated, she made herself quite available to the press for a few months here in the United States and in the United Kingdom. I mean, she was going back to Pakistan to run for prime minister. She wanted to get the publicity, and you know, she's working for, in her mind, her country. And again, let's step into the Wayback Machine here. Back to December 26th, 2001. This is a couple of months after 9/11. December 26, 2001. An Egyptian newspaper ran an article, Dateline Islamabad, and you'll find the links to it and all of this. There's a good thread about this over at the Democratic Underground at democraticunderground.com. And apparently Mike Malloy and Kathy Malloy, Kathy had dug some of this up last night. And a tip of the hat to Mike Malloy, an old friend and one of the best guys in radio. I didn't hear the show, but this is the comment that I'm hearing in my chat room, and that he might have first brought this out. If so, congratulations. Here's this article in Islamabad. A prominent official in the Afghan Taliban movement announced yesterday the death of Osama bin Laden. Now, this is December 26th, the day after Christmas, 2001. The death of Osama bin Laden, the chief of the Al-Qaeda organization, stating that bin Laden suffered serious complications in the lungs and died of a natural and quiet death. The official, who asked to remain anonymous, stated to the Observer of Pakistan that he had himself attended the funeral of bin Laden and saw his face prior to burial in Tora Bora 10 days ago. He mentioned that 30 of Al-Qaeda's fighters attended the burial, as well as members of his family and some friends from the Taliban. In the farewell ceremony to his final rest, guns were fired in the air. The official stated that it is difficult to pinpoint the burial location of bin Laden because, according to the Wahhabi tradition, no mark is left by the grave. He stressed it is unlikely that the American forces would ever uncover any trace of bin Laden. So, you know, we've known about this story for years, for 5 years now, 6 years. But here comes this interview with David Frost and Benazir Bhutto. And he's asking her about, you know, the opposition, and is she going to carry on? Is she going to soldier on?
To know the risks you've got to take.
This is one of the reasons that I traveled from Karachi to Dubai. I wanted to console my children. I couldn't come immediately after the bomb blast because we had to tend to the wounded.
Now, she's talking about the first assassination attempt against her.
And also condole with the families, and I had to pray at my father's grave. But I came here to be with them. They were asleep when the midnight blasts took place, and in the morning they got text messages from their friends saying, "We hope your mother is well." They were pretty.
Now, this, by the way, this interview is the 2nd of November.
Pretty upset, and then their father came into the room and said, "I have something to tell you." And they said, "Well, Dad, we already know." They're coping, but obviously they worry. They do want me to continue, though. They understand that I'm doing this for their country and for all the people of Pakistan.
That's a marvelous story because it underlines the way that our children these days get their information almost before we do.
That's right. And not only our children, but what has really, in a sense, I'm overwhelmed and in a bit also feel a tremendous sense of responsibility, a burden of responsibility, because one of the mothers who lost her sons in this terrorist attack that took place in Karachi has just volunteered her other son to join up as one of my security guards in Rawalpindi.
So she goes through this, and then she drops this bombshell, And here it comes.
Who was in an Indian jail for decapitating three British tourists.
She's talking about Ahmed Omar Saeed Sheikh, also known as Omar Sheikh.
And three American tourists. And he also had dealings with Omar Sheikh, the man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Now, I know that having dealings with...
Now, what? The man who murdered Osama bin Laden? Now, this is not an accidental statement. This is, you know, this is a woman who is very careful about how she speaks.
Who was in an Indian jail for decapitating three British tourists and three American tourists. And he also had dealings with Omar Sheikh, the man who murdered Osama bin Laden. Now, I know that having dealings with people does not necessarily mean direct evidence, but I also know that internal security has totally collapsed in Pakistan and that internal security cannot collapse without there being some blind eye, if not collusion, being turned to the rise of the militants and militancy. Not only are our tribal areas out of our control, but even the beautiful valley of Swat is now under takeover by Islamists. So I would like to see a Pak-led police inquiry assisted by Scotland Yard or the FBI come in, use their forensic and scientific explanation to find out not only the perpetrators, but the financiers and the organizers.
Here she is, basically suggesting that the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, has been infiltrated and that, by people including the guy who assassinated Osama bin Laden, who murdered Osama bin Laden. Now, David Frost never picked up on that, and which kind of blows my mind. And as far as I can tell, pretty much nobody else did. I mean, you Google it and you find some references, but it's like, here's Benazir Bhutto just laying this out like, well, you know, yesterday the sun came up and Osama bin Laden's dead. Now, why would that be bad news for George Bush? Right after this, 16 minutes past the hour.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocky was looked on as something shocking. Now, heaven knows.
Anything Goes Friday, 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Some of the best, the worst, and the weirdest audio of the year, too, will be sprinkling throughout the show.
You got to kill the terrorists before the killing stops. And I'm for the president. Chase them all over the world. If it takes 10 years, blow them all away in the name of the Lord.
Well, thank you. The Reverend Jerry Falwell no longer with us. But Michael Savage is.
It's a bloodthirsty religionist practiced over there by a bunch of throwbacks of where to kill them.
Yeah, and of course Bill O'Reilly's still
on. So, all those clowns over at the liberal radio network, we could incarcerate them immediately. Will you have that done, please? Send over the FBI and just put them in chains?
Hmm. Anyhow, we'll play some more audio here for you. 1-866-303-2270 as we go on through the day. 866-303-2270, our telephone number, tomhartman.com for our live chat room. Linda in Hillsburg, California. Hey, Linda, welcome to the program. Linda? Can you hear me, Linda? Can you hear me now, Linda? Apparently, Linda is not there. Let's go to Teresa in Napa, California. Hey, Teresa.
Hi, Tom. How are you? Happy New Year.
I'm well. Thank you. Happy New Year to you, too.
I'm calling because just this morning, the CNN and the other national TV stations are saying Al-Qaeda and the Taliban are responsible for Bhutto's death. And I'm venting, I guess. I am so sick of the news telling us things and just acting like we're going to believe it, no matter what it is.
Yeah.
Anyone who's read a mystery novel knows, you know, first you look at who has the motive and then who has the means, and it's Musharraf and Musharraf.
Yeah.
The fact that Negroponte was there a couple weeks ago doesn't bode well either for anyone who's familiar with his past.
Yeah.
And I know on the surface he has said that he sent her in, that they supported him. But I wouldn't put anything past this administration, and I wouldn't be at all surprised if we find out at some time that we supported her going back just so she'd be an easy target so we could keep Musharraf. And I know it may sound conspiratorial, but I'm just, you know, I trust them to do the wrong thing for the wrong reason, I guess. You know,
right, and these things are not mutually exclusive, Teresa. I mean, you could have, for example, it's entirely possible that Al-Qaeda was responsible for 9/11, and George Bush knew it was going to happen, maybe not these specific details, and he
You're
let it happen.
You're exactly right.
And
you're right.
It's entirely possible that Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, I mean, they do have alliances. They certainly did in Afghanistan, are behind this in some way, or at least some people who are associated with it. And Musharraf knew it was going to happen, and he let it happen.
Probably more the truth. You're right.
Yeah, it's much simpler than some sort of grand conspiracy thing. You know, it's just I thought it was strange that there was only one way out of the venue that she was speaking in. I mean, that just doesn't make sense that there would be only one possible exit and everybody knew what it was. It's just
And you know, it also happened in Rawalpindi, which is like the one of the major cities with most military, and they were saying a week or two ago, if anything happens to her, it's not going to happen without the military being aware it's going on.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, nothing happens in Pakistan without the ISI and the military knowing. Teresa, thank you very much for the call. Well said. Max in Seal Beach, California. Hey, Max.
Hi, Tom. Pleasure to talk to you for the first time.
Thank you for calling.
Thank you. I am amazed that Pakistan, which you said has a 50% literacy rate, or illiterate, has a nuclear arsenal.
Yep.
And other countries, which are much better educated, don't have nuclear weapons. How is that possible? Do you know?
Yeah, it's possible because essentially we and a number of other countries were making a deal with the devil back in the day. The history of the development of the bomb in Pakistan is long and convoluted. India also developed a bomb. India and refused to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Agreement. There was this perception that Bush was helping India. I really probably should stop at that point because I'm not sufficiently expert or knowledgeable about the long history of how we got to that point to give you an accurate and concise answer. And maybe one of our listeners is. It is, though, absolutely shocking, and it's one of the reasons why it's so important that we pay attention to this part of the world, and it's one of the reasons why I think that over the short term, Musharraf at least is providing some stability. You know, here's the old, you know, he's an SOB, but he's our SOB. On the other hand, to hold an election 2 weeks after the major opposition party's only candidate has been assassinated seems to me like a mistake.
It also seems like a smoking gun, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was astounded to hear that George Bush called up Musharraf and said, please go ahead with the elections. I would think that he would call up and say, you know, the election date, I mean, this is, here in the United States, the date of elections is constitutionally mandated. And so my analogy or metaphor of, you know, what happened if John Kerry and John Edwards had been blown away in 2004, you know, God forbid, is imperfect because our Constitution specifies the date for the elections. The Indian Constitution doesn't. It's the kind of government where the government basically says, okay, here, we're going to have the elections on this date, and Musharraf has, at least as my understanding of it is correct, has the power to define the date that the elections are going to be held. And I would think that George Bush would have said to him, you know, maybe you want to move the elections back a month. I mean, assure everybody that you're going to have them. But move them back 6 weeks or 8 weeks. Give the opposition party, Benazir Bhutto's party, enough time to field a candidate and get that candidate some publicity so that you can actually have some sort of a democratic election. 27 minutes past the hour. And welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Boy, a lot on our table, a lot going on for the year. Some of the best and the worst of the audio for the year. Don Siegelman, the governor of Arkansas, excuse me, of Alabama, was lost the reelection in the middle of the night when in the most Republican district, all of a sudden they found a bunch of ballots. And now is in prison. Many people think he's a political prisoner in the United States. Here's Don Siegelman.
I do know that during my term as governor, I never saw Bill Pryor, the Republican Attorney General, do anything outside of Alabama law except to allow the early certification of the results that swung the election from me to my Republican opponent.
Mr. Riley, and Pryor then was given a federal judgeship as apparently reward for that.
What was disappointing was after the polls had closed, after midnight, when the poll workers, the Democratic poll workers and the Republican poll workers and representatives of the media had gone home, the election officials, all of whom are Republicans, got together and recounted the votes. In that process, I lost some 6,700 votes, enough to swing the election from me to my Republican opponent. Poll workers should have been present during that process. And secondly, the results should not have been certified the next day.
Yeah, to say the very least.
After we had made an official request for a hand count of the ballots in Baldwin County, and after the Attorney General and the Republican District Attorney had said they would put anyone in jail who attempted a hand recount, the votes were suddenly rushed to Montgomery, certified by the Republican Secretary of State, which put us at a disadvantage.
Yeah, and ended up with this guy, Don Siegelman, in jail.
Under Alabama law, the anyone who wants to challenge the election must show that there were enough legal votes not counted or illegal votes cast to make a difference in the outcome. Well, the person challenging the election should have been my Republican opponent because the votes that should have been certified on 12 noon on Friday following the election should have been that first vote, which was publicly counted in front of poll watchers.
Right, in which Siegelman, the Democrat, won.
When this election was stolen, there's no other real kind or sugar-coated way to say it, I was faced with a difficult choice because it was a close election. We had won by what we thought was around 3,000 votes, and we ended up losing by, I think, 1,500 votes. It would have been difficult for me to have challenged the outcome of that election. One, because they were denying me a hand recount. Secondly, even if we were to have ultimately gotten a recount from a Republican federal judge, very doubtful, from a Republican circuit judge, very doubtful, from a Republican-dominated state Supreme Court, we have one Democrat on the court, very doubtful, after what the United States Supreme Court had just done to Al Gore, I looked at the possibility of winning a legal challenge and thought, even if I were to win by any stretch of the imagination, if I could have won, then I was afraid that people would have looked at me and said, Sigelman stole the election because it was so close. So I decided to walk away from that, thinking that, it's best to come back and fight another day.
A fateful decision, it turns out.
I think some of my Republican friends here thought that, well, if he's coming back to fight another day, let's see if we can't make that fight a little more difficult for him.
Yeah, which they have done. They charged him with the corruption for putting a campaign donor on an unpaid advisory board for a hospital commission. And for this, he was sentenced to prison, to federal prison, and he has for several years now been moved from federal prison, unavailable to speak to the press, held incommunicado. This guy, Don Siegelman, the former Democratic governor of Alabama, another one of the vote thefts. This is where I keep saying we need to be looking at what's happening with the U.S. prosecutors who kept their jobs, because the woman who kept her job, who Bush appointed as the federal prosecutor in Alabama, who put this guy in prison, her husband was the campaign manager for the Republican who ran against him. And her husband's partner in that was Karl Rove. And you tell me that crimes have not been, that the United States is not being run like a banana republic, and that the Republican Party these days isn't operating and acting like the mafia under Marcello and Trafficante. Andrew at Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
First, real quick, I wanted to let you know that my copies of We the People and my autographed copy of Screwed are in the hands of a rock-ribbed Republican living in Mississippi.
My mom.
I hope she enjoys reading them.
Well, you know, she doesn't know why I sent them, but she's, you know, the first, she's reading We the People first. And hopefully she can send them.
That's great. I think that We the People and What Would Jefferson Do are two of the best introductory books that I wrote on the history of American politics and how it relates to right
why
now.
This country was formed.
Yeah. And what it means right now.
Yeah. Very apropos to my comment, I was going to bring it up to Senator Sanders, if you could run this past him at some point. It seems to me that we're not really going to, you know, be able to work through the layers of justice and the rule of law until we have a Supreme Court that's truly a impartial court. That if there's any way that we could impeach one, two, possibly three of those.
That's not going to happen, Andrew. The Constitution does provide for the impeachment of senior officers in the federal government, which would include the Supreme Court. But they would have to be, there would have to be articles of impeachment in the House of Representatives. There would have to be a trial in the Senate. It would take something far more than Mr. Thomas recently saying that he doesn't really like his job. to my mind, that's like, well, why did you, you know, allow them to put you there in the first place? But nonetheless, Clarence Thomas saying that he doesn't get the big house, he doesn't get the big bucks, and as a Supreme Court justice, he doesn't get to retire early and become a lobbyist like Trent Lott does. No, it ain't going to happen. Impeachment of the Supreme Court is not going to happen. Instead, the thing that we have to worry about, Andrew, is the fact that the next president coming along in 388 days, 10 hours, 10 minutes, and 52 seconds, the next president of the United States is probably going to appoint at least two Supreme Court justices. I mean, you got John Paul Stevens, I think he's 85 years old. You got Ruth Bader Ginsburg, is rather elderly, and she has had cancer. There are several members, and you know, you just never know what fate is going to, what, you know, hand, what cards fate is going to deal you. And the next president of the United States is almost certainly going to appoint at least one and possibly more members of the United States Supreme Court. And if that is a Republican, and if it's a Republican who appoints, quote, strict constructionist judges, end quote, although I would submit to you that these four, going on five with Mr. Kennedy, justices, the main thing that they have in common, I suppose, is that they're conservative and that they're Catholic. These five justices have been the most activist on the court since the middle years of the Warren court, because they have overturned more laws and made more changes in law than any of their predecessors or many of their predecessors. But nonetheless, if a Republican comes in and appoints another John Roberts, another corporate lawyer who makes his living, John Roberts made his living pushing for corporate personhood, or another Antonin Scalia, you know, a right wing ideologue, if another one of them gets on the court, we're in big trouble. This presidential election is massively important, regardless of what you may think of all the individual candidates on the Democratic side. Any Democrat is going to be better than any Republican because of the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court is massive. We're talking about one third of the federal, you know, the three-part federal system of government. One third of our government, for all practical purposes in terms of power, is going to be decided by the next president. And so it's really important to get out there and work on that. Bob in Brooklyn, New York. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi. I saw the demos, last sponsor. You asked about Indian.
Bob, I'm sorry. Your phone is breaking up really badly. If you're calling on a cell phone, I'm going to put you on hold. We'll come back to you if you'd like, if you think that you can make that work. Scott in Harlem, New York. Hey, Scott.
Yes, Mr. Hartman. Let me just say that this is a pleasure. I listen to you every day when I'm at work, but I'm not allowed to say that.
Okay. Thank you, Scott.
I listen to you quite a bit. I'm glad you got this earlier slot because, I mean, it was terrible before, but you are a man. I saw you on C-SPAN, which was great as well.
Oh, thank you. No, it's a real honor replacing Al Franken here on Air America. We have few seconds here before the break, Scott. Your point or question, comment?
Oh, man, is it possible? Because I'm going to probably need about 20 seconds. Can I get carried over just for 20 seconds?
You got 20 seconds right now.
Okay. There's two things that I want to...
Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah, okay. I'll give you 20 seconds on the other side. I didn't realize the machine was going to start. Hang on, Scott. Stick around. We'll put you on the other side. It's 45 minutes past the hour. It's Anything Goes Friday. Happy New Year's to you. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Stick around. We'll be right back. 832-70, our phone number, TomHartman.com, if you want to drop into our live chat room, AirAmerica.com for the blog over there as well.
Truth in Broadcasting. This is the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Happy New Year. Welcome back. 9.5 minutes before the hour. Scott Harlem. Scott, you were going to make a point there. And then we've got Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service to give us an update on what's going on in Washington, D.C. this morning.
Yes, sir. A few points. Number one, I am a non-combat disabled veteran, African-American, so I wanted to put that on there. I wanted to just read you two sentences from two different articles that I wish that we, especially you and other people, will explore, but I know Mr. Malloy does. The first sentence that I'm going to read you was written by a man named Paul Lima, who was the staff writer for the Bergen Record of New Jersey. This is what he wrote on Wednesday, September 12, 2001. 8 hours after terrorist attacks struck Manhattan's tallest skyscrapers, police in Bergen County detained five men who were found carrying maps linking them to blasts. The five men who were in a van stopped on Route 3 in East Rutherford, New Jersey, around 4:30, were being questioned by police, but had not been charged with a late crime.
Yeah, however, I'm familiar with the story, Scott.
I'm sorry, sir?
I'm familiar with the story.
Okay, so we have Israeli Mossad agents who were caught with maps and everything and money in their socks, which is what the next sentence was going to say.
Yeah.
Money in their socks.
That was the allegation.
Yeah, well, it was an allegation, sir. When you say allegation, Mr. Harbin, when you say allegation, it means there's a possibility without facts. These guys was arrested. They were photographed. They were caught. And if you go to YouTube and you type in a damn.
Scott, are you suggesting that Mossad was behind 9/11? Is that the bottom line here?
The bottom line is what I'm saying is this. The bottom line is what I'm saying is this. Let's accuse the people who were actually physically caught. Obviously, they can't do it themselves, so they needed help. And may I just
Scott,
make
Scott? I'm gonna stop it right there, Scott, because I'm gonna tell you there could be 100 different people who would call. Each one of them has their own list of here's who we know for sure did it, and I'm not gonna go there. And it's got nothing to do with whether or not it was Mossad or whether or not it was there was explosives planted in the building or whether it was Mr. Silverman or whether it was George Bush or whatever. We've done that show. We've had that discussion. We will come back to that discussion at some time when there's an appropriate time for it. But, Scott, you had your say and thanks for calling. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
The White House just announced just a few minutes ago and had a conference call with various press people that the president is going to issue a veto for the Defense Authorization Act specifically because of Section 1083. This has to do with lawsuits. It was put forth by Frank Lautenberg as an amendment, and it obviously passed, which would allow certain lawsuits to take place. Now, some people are saying that these lawsuits in specific are from the first Gulf War and have to do with prisoners of war, et cetera. And this would hold the Iraqi government or other governments responsible for any terrorism that they may have perpetrated on individuals or groups. And there are some of these lawsuits that have been thrown out at this point. This would also attach Iraqi assets. The bill went through. Somehow the White House, they claim they raised objections to it before the bill was passed in letters, but the leadership said that Pelosi and Reid issued a statement just a few minutes ago saying that they were not aware of their objections and they could have worked with their objections. And the other thing is Iraqi assets would somehow then be held up if there was a lawsuit filed. What's fascinating about this, it looks like both in Reconstruction money and just plain old Iraqi assets, there are billions sitting in American banks. which is, it looks like some of the leadership is accusing the Bush administration of being afraid that the Iraqis are upset because some of their billions of dollars that they have in American banks may be up for grabs. Now, Ike Skelton...
Up for grab house.
Up for grabs in terms of they could be held in a possible lawsuit and not released until the lawsuit is resolved.
Oh, interesting.
Now, that's sort of number one. The other interesting thing is how many billions of dollars, and I didn't get to ask that question. I did ask the question about what specific cases were involved. But the question I wanted to know is how many billions of dollars of Iraq money is in the United States. That would be a very interesting question as well.
Yeah, it would. And how many billions of U.S. dollars have gone into Iraq and just fallen into holes that we've never seen before, that we have no idea where they went? How many billions of dollars have gone to contractors with absolutely no accountability? How many billions of dollars have just been squandered by this administration? And why is it that we're, instead of rebuilding a country, we're trying to put down an insurgency, which wouldn't have happened in the first place if we'd actually started rebuilding the country? I mean, we didn't have, not a single U.S. GI was shot in Japan or Germany after World War II. There was no insurgency. Why? Because we were helping them rebuild their countries. Don't get me started.
Exactly. Exactly. I would just simply say that the other issue is when they notified Pelosi and Reid, and whether they were really notified or whether they were caught by surprise when the Iraqis read the bill. They're saying no, they've raised objections to this.
They being the administration?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Other reporters on the call, and this was a conference call from the White House, were not so sure.
So it sounds like this might be the White House trying to spin something, trying to do something for political advantage and spin it in a way that makes it look like it was the Iraqis who were...
No, I actually think they may have been caught by surprise.
The White House was caught by surprise.
It may be. And they said that they've known about this, that they addressed this in some of the letters, but...
Hmm. And the ultimate effect of this is going to be what?
The ultimate effect is going to be that he's vetoing the bill... and this was this precious, they wanted to make sure that they had
the defense appropriation,
so they could
right.
get the money to the troops.
Right, and so that they didn't have to lay off all these civilian contractors.
Right.
So are civilians going to be laid off now?
No, I don't think so. I think they're going to borrow money because they think it'll be passed immediately when Congress returns.
Right, or they can pull it out of their back pocket. I mean, it's not like the Pentagon
exactly.
budget doesn't have a little extra in it. So, which brings us back to the whole thing that, we're going to have to lay off all these people just before Christmas was a canard to begin with. It was a joke. Ellen Ratter, Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Hartman.
Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman Program brought to you in part by the 200,000 health and hospital workers at SEIU 1199, fighting for quality, affordable health care for all Americans. Keeping our families healthy should be a right, not a privilege. And welcome back to the third hour of program. Happy New Year's, the best and worst of the year. This we did a show a couple weeks ago on telemarketing, and Tom Mabes has a website, M-A-B-E-S, on which he does spoof calls, or actually receives them. These are all legitimate calls where people actually call into him, and he just, you know, plays with them and records them. And this was a telemarketer calling Tom Mabes. As I said, you can find it over at his website, and here it is.
Yes, can I speak with Tom Mabes?
Who's calling?
Well, this is Mike Stern with Network. You've been selected to receive a complete digital satellite system for free. With this, you're going to...
Let me ask you something. Did you know Tom Mabe? Were you a friend of his?
Now, this is where it starts to get real interesting.
No, I'm not. I'm just calling to...
Hold on one second, all right? Hey, guys, get really good pictures of the body. Yeah, and dust everything down for prints. Mike, you there?
Yeah.
Let me bring you up to speed. You've actually called a murder scene. Mr. Mabe is no longer with us.
I'm Officer Clark. I'm conducting a homicide investigation. I want to ask you a series of questions. First of all, what was the nature of the business you had with Tom Mabe?
And now the telemarketer. I'm amazed that the guy even stays in the line. Now the telemarketer is starting to get a little nervous here as Tom Mabe's playing a cop is playing him along.
I had no business with him. I'm sorry to bother you.
No, hey, hold on. Look, I want to ask you to stay on the phone. This call's already been traced, and we may need you to come in for further questioning.
You don't understand. I'm just calling on...
No, look, you don't understand. Unless you want to be charged with obstruction of justice, it's imperative you keep your ass on the phone, Mike.
Well, how about you just talk with my supervisor then?
No, look, we'll get your supervisor in a second here. First of all, give me your whereabouts.
I'm at work.
You're at work?
Yes.
You being a smartass?
No, sir.
Let me put it to you this way, Mike. Say I wanted to mail your letter. What would I have to write on the outside of the envelope to ensure the mailman would deliver it right to your ass? Geographically speaking, Mike, where is work?
4715 West Street.
Now, hold on. That's 478?
Yes, sir.
Mike, hold on one second, all right?
Yes. Yeah.
Get the Littleton Police Department Homicide Division on the phone.
And the telemarketer's in Littleton, Colorado, and he says, get the Littleton Police Homicide Division on the phone. Now the telemarketer's really freaking out.
Yeah, give him this information. You tell him he's being a sock connection with a fatal shooting and aggravated robbery. But how did you know Mr. Mabe again?
Well, wait, you're calling the Littleton Police Department? I'm hundreds of miles away. I don't even know the guy. I'm in Colorado.
No, don't let that scare you. That's just a formality. Have you ever been to his place of residence?
No.
Right, and tell me again, where were you last night between the hours of 8 and 10?
I'm not feeling real comfortable by any of this.
Have you even ever spoken with Mr. Mabe, Mike?
No, I haven't. I don't even know the guy. That's what I've been trying to tell you.
Okay, just calm down. Calm down. Hold on. Look, just back up. I got one more question for you, Mike. As you well know, I'm sure, Mr. Mabe was a flaming homosexual. And there's no easy way of asking that. I don't want to embarrass you or nothing, but were you his gay lover?
What? No. What kind of a question?
Look. If gay is your way, that's okay. I still know there's a lot of you gay people in the closet. I'm not saying I haven't thought about myself. You know? Say I was in Las Vegas or something, a couple drinks. Cute little Mexican midget.
This is ambiguous.
At this point, the telemarketer has totally lost it. So, the best and the worst of the world, or the best and the worst of the year. Yeah, here's the worst.
Viciously attacked us before we're in Iraq, and they've been attacking ever since. They are a threat to your children, David. And whoever's in that Oval Office better understand it and take measures necessary to protect the American people.
George Bush telling David Gregory that he better be afraid that somebody's coming after his children. Yeah. And here's back to the best. Joe Wilson on his reaction and his wife's book on the possibility of a pardon for Scooter Libby.
I take no satisfaction in this. I think that the idea of a senior White House official being convicted of obstruction of justice and perjury is something that ought to sadden everybody who believes in public service.
Yeah, and it should, but it didn't seem to.
Well, I think she wept when she heard the news. I was actually in a restaurant in D.C., and she called me up, and she just said, 4 out of 5, guilty. And she was very relieved, I think. She will sleep well tonight. Knowing again that this part of this ordeal is behind us.
Yeah, little did they know that coming right down the road was going to be the pardoning of Mr. Libby, Scooter Libby, I. Lewis Libby. Yeah. So here's another good one. This is Bruce Fine, who's been a guest on this program a number of times. This was him on PBS.
He is seeking more
speaking of George Bush.
He is seeking more institutionally to cripple checks and balances and the authority of Congress and the judiciary to superintend his assertions of power.
Bruce Fine, I should add, was number two in, as I recall, the Justice Department in the Reagan administration.
He has claimed the authority to tell Congress they don't have any right to know what he's doing with relation to spying on American citizens, using that information in any way that he wants, in contradiction to a federal statute called the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. He's claimed authority to say he can kidnap people, throw them into dungeons abroad, dump them out into Siberia without any political or legal accountability. These are standards that are totally anathema to a democratic society devoted to the rule of law.
Amen. Thank you, Bruce Fine. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. And Matt in Napa, California. Hey, Matt. Matt, you are on the air.
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I wanted to follow up a little bit on the homegrown terrorism bill and some testimony that went in front of Harmon subcommittee that I don't think you've talked about with Mark Weitzman of the Simon Wiesenthal Center, where he started to discuss 9/11 truth sites in the context of homegrown terrorism, and referred to Richard Gage as site as one of these. And I just think that that is really something that people should know about.
Yeah, we did an entire program on it, and I've talked about it a number of times, this House Resolution 1955, Senate Bill 1959, and how it creates thought crimes, and whether the thought crimes are that you're investigating 9/11, and there is a lot of good people who are doing it, and they're uncovering a lot of major and massive inconsistencies with the official story, or whether you're taking on the federal government, or whether you're taking on the Bush administration, or frankly, whether you're taking on one of the big corporate sponsors of all these politicians, you too can be labeled a terrorist, and you too could end up in Guantanamo ultimately. Now that's the second half of that. Even the first half of that isn't specific to the bill, but what the bill does is it redefines the language. It defines a whole new category of thought crimes, and I think it's a dangerous step on the road toward fascism, frankly. Marty in San Luis Obispo, California. Hey, Marty. Marty, you're on the air.
Yes, Tom. Hi.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to kind of pick up on what was being discussed earlier, I guess, when Bernie Sanders was there about voting, voting integrity. I'm in the computer business, and so it's been a fascinating subject for me. And I just about abandoned all hope that electronic voting could be secure and accurate and reliable, and go back to strictly to paper voting, the way the old days were done, and say, hey, you're not going to have
the way every other democracy in the world does it. You mean
exactly. But I've come to understand that there are people who have developed electronic voting systems based on a specific concept of electronic ballot printing, where first you have a paper ballot.
Basically, the voting machine is simply driving a fancy printer.
And
it's a fancy printing machine, and you're printing the ballot, and then the ballot is read by a scanner. Yeah, that seems like a reasonable way to do it. If the software and the computer itself is owned by the government and is tested by people who are answerable to we the people. Because, again, I mean, how often, particularly if it's a complex ballot, I mean, in some of the larger states like California, you might have a whole bunch of ballot initiatives. You'd have a ballot that's huge. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff on it. Somebody's going to print that thing out, and you'd carefully examine every single thing on it to make sure that it says exactly what the button they pushed is, particularly if it's some obscure ballot measure that somebody's trying to flip. Anything electronic, I am suspicious of. I'll just put that right up front. 16 minutes past the hour. Minutes past the hour. It's Friday the 28th of December. Anything Goes Friday. We'll also be rebroadcasting this as a best of show on New Year's Day. So happy New Year's Day to you. Jackie in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, Jackie.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was going to say something else, but they just played Anything Goes, and how perfect that is as an example of what this administration does. And I'd like to know, what are considered high crimes and misdemeanors, and why are impeachment proceedings not brought against these two people, the president and the vice president? Because anyone that has the power to do something about this mess and doesn't is complicit in their crimes, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you, Jackie, and I think it's a great tragedy that the Democratic leadership did not, in their first year in office, take the opportunity to begin serious investigations like Robert Wexler is now calling for, of impeachable crimes, with the possibility of impeachment being down the road. We're now into the election season, you know, going into this next year. It's going to be really politically very tough to do it, although legally, you know, hopefully, some of these Senate and House investigations will uncover, not that there aren't already, I mean, the violations of the FISA Act, for example, Bush is bragging about, but will uncover things that the American people perceive to be crimes. The biggest problem that I've seen, Jackie, is that, and thank you for the call, is that the media, the corporate media in the United States, and I've got a number of emails from people suggesting, well, maybe this is some sort of psychological defense mechanism, you know, denial. The corporate media in the United States will not point out when the Bush administration has committed crimes, will not call them crimes, will not frame them in the context of impeachability or even prosecutability, if there is such a word. Instead, they, well, you know, is this legal or is it not? You know, I mean, it's all couched and all. Whereas when it was Clinton, Clinton gets it on with Monica Lewinsky and lied about it. Holy cow, that's a crime. That's impeachable. And they just went off on it. And I don't believe that it's just that, you know, if it's about sex, the media loves it, and if it's not, they don't. I mean, that's one of the theories that's out there, is that the American media, the corporate media in America, thinks that Americans are so stupid that, you know, they can understand sex crimes, but they don't understand anything else. I don't believe it. I think it's that the guys in this administration have been so good to the major multinational and transnational corporations of the world, who in large part control most of the quote news, end quote, that you get in the United States, that they're not covering the stories. They're just not doing it. Ryan in Michigan. Hey, Ryan, welcome to the program.
How you doing today, Tom?
Just great, but I'll get better. What's up, Ryan?
Oh, I hate to break up the subject that's going on, but I want to speak about charter schools today. And I'm not an expert on this subject by any means, but just kind of, you know, noticed a few things since I've taught in a few of them. And charter schools, it almost seems like the children are starting to run the school system in a way where I believe they compete over the child, because in a charter school system, isn't it where the school receives X amount of money per child? Is that correct?
Yeah, it varies. I believe it varies from state to state and how they're set up. I don't claim any super expertise on charter schools specifically. I haven't been involved with one. I am on the board of a private school, which is not a charter school in New Hampshire, the Hutter School, hutterschool.org, which is just a private school for ADHD kids. The bottom line with charter schools, in my opinion, is that this is part of the larger effort to privatize public education. That, you know, going back to Reagan, and obviously long before Reagan, but Reagan really began this, is this notion that the whole idea of a New Deal, the whole idea of a civil society, the whole idea of the government, we the people, being involved in providing some social safety net and some sort of social infrastructure for the rest of the nation, which ranges from public health care to public education, is socialism or communism, and therefore is to be opposed. And this is what we're seeing down in New Orleans now. The majority of the schools, my understanding is the majority of the schools that have been opened now are either private schools or charter schools. And it's an attempt to ghettoize the public schools. You end up with the only schools that are there, that are still running, are the public schools in the very worst neighborhoods, and they're going to be the most underperforming. And then they go, see, look at, public schools don't work. And it's a way of trying to kill public education. You'll recall Reagan wanted to do away with the Federal Department of Education.
Okay, right. And I noticed that, you know, so they end up competing over every child, these different schools. And what happens is the children know that they can just leave that school. I'm not an expert, but they can leave that school and go to another one if they're not happy at that school. So you can't, it's almost hard to, you can't discipline them really, and you can't get them, they could just refuse to work on anything and leave the school if they're not happy at that school. It almost seems like, so the school then wants to make that child as happy as can be no matter what, so they can keep the money, because that's how, does that make sense to you?
The school also wants to make the parents happy, and so they want to be providing a decent education. There is a balancing act there. And there is something to be said for competition, but I would say competition among public schools at some level. But even when you talk about competition, what it does is it ignores the really important part of the equation, which is that schools are essentially community efforts, and communities are disparate. You've got some communities that have a lot of wealth and a lot of resources, and others that don't. And you can't just judge one school against another in a vacuum without taking those things into consideration. 27 minutes past the hour.
We'll talk a cup of kindness yet for days above land sun.
34 minutes past the hour. The worst and the best of 2007. Here's a little bit more of the worst of 2007. Glenn Beck going off on a crazy rant.
And I read this one part on global warming about how they got, what was the first thing they did to get people to exterminate the Jews. Now, I'm not saying that anybody's going to, you know, Al Gore's not going to be rounding up Jews and exterminating them. It is the same tactic, however. The goal is different. The goal is globalization. The goal is global carbon tax. The goal is the United Nations running the world. That is the goal. Back in the 1930s, the goal was get rid of all of the Jews and have one global government.
So Al Gore and Adolf Hitler, same goal, same mission, same job. Worst of the year, Glenn Beck. Best of the year, Michael Moore, talking back to CNN.
You want to respond?
Well, first of all,
to anything we just heard?
Yeah, I'd like about 10 minutes to respond to.
Give us a couple headlines. What you'd like to say?
I don't talk in sound bites, so that report was so biased. I can't imagine what pharmaceutical company ads coming up right after our break here. But you know, why don't you tell the truth to the American people? I mean, I wish that CNN and the other mainstream media would just for once tell the truth about what's going on in this country, whether it's with health care. I don't care what it is. I mean, you guys have such a poor track record. And for me to come on here and have to listen to that kind of crap, I mean, seriously, I haven't been on your show now for 3 years. The last time I was on, you ran a similar piece about Fahrenheit 9/11 saying, oh, this can't be true, what he's saying about the war, how it's going to be a quagmire, the weapons of mass destruction. You know, and why don't you start off, actually, with my first appearance back here on your show in 3 years and maybe apologize to me for saying that 3 years ago, because it turned out everything I said in Fahrenheit was true. Everything's come to happen. Everything I said, I mean, I took you in that film to Walter Reed Hospital. And it took 3 years before you or any of the rest of the mainstream media would go to Walter Reed Hospital and see what was happening to our troops. So for me to have to sit here and listen again to more crap about socialized medicine or how the Canadians have it, you know, worse than us and all this, all the statistics show that we have a far worse health care than these other industrialized countries. We're the only ones that don't have it free and universal. And, you know, there's a...
And then he goes on. Michael Moore, the best of the year, and his movie Sicko, one of the absolutely very best. Tom in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Long wait. I'm going to catch my breath here. I've got an approach, I think, to war funding that I haven't heard anybody else say. My preference is probably a lot of your listeners would be that the Democrats just got together and cut it off entirely, but obviously that's not going to happen. So I'm looking at this as my premise is that Bush wants, close to his heart, he has two wishes. One, he remains a wartime president in his entire term. The second is that he goes out of office having never raised taxes, unlike his father, so he doesn't have to go back on that pledge. To me, it's within the power of Congress and the Democrats to make Bush choose between those two. So what I would like to see is for the Democratic leadership to get together and say, from now on, it's pay as you go. So we're not going to fight the president on the war funding, but we're going to make him absolutely make
it. Yeah, this is what Bush ridiculed in the 2004 election, where he ridiculed Kerry for advocating what he called paygo. And,
right. But if he did it just on the war, what I love about this concept is the Democratic leadership, suppose they've said, okay, we have to raise taxes if you're going to do this. Now, we'd like your ideas, Mr. President. Who would you like to tax? Should we tax everybody equally so we don't penalize the successful? Or should we make it based on income? Maybe we should do a fuel tax. Put the president on record. Which is the best tax? What would you prefer? Because you're not going to get dime one unless you raise taxes.
Right. We're not going to add it to the deficit. Now, here's the problem. The Democrats and the Republicans just voted to raise the deficit ceiling. I mean, the way to do that would have been not to vote to raise it.
They could still, yes, they voted to raise the deficit ceiling, that's fine, but they could still, there's nothing that would stop them from doing this.
Yeah.
And it would be a very interesting concept because people who want to support the troops then would have to open their wallets.
Yeah. And so far we've spent about $10,000 per American on this thing. It's
now,
like, how much more is it going to be?
Now, the other thing is, you wrap this up in the election. I've talked to a number of people. It's extremely frustrating, including members of my own family, I'm ashamed to say, who said, well, you know, the Democrats want to raise taxes when they get into office. And so we all know, I mean, any rational human being knows that there's going to have to be, we're going to have to increase revenues or we're going to be buried in debt and have to go bankrupt. So, yes, of course, the Democrats are going to raise taxes. So it would be smart for the Democrats to put the Republicans on record right now and get that bogeyman off our backs and make the Republicans raise taxes or end this war now.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is you could say, well, we want to support our troops. Let's exempt immediate families of people serving in Iraq from this increase.
That's a good suggestion, Tom. And that might be politically palatable. I absolutely agree with you. I think it's brilliant. And I hope, you know, you live here in Portland. I hope that you will let your member of the House of Representatives and both your senators know that, you know, your suggestion on that. And I'll support that. I mean, I'll talk about it on the radio more often. We should be paying for this occupation. If we're going to maintain this occupation, if we're going to maintain the empire, you know, Pax Americana, if we're going to maintain empire, military bases in 100 countries around the world, we should be paying for it. Sam in Bloomfield, New Jersey. Hey, Sam.
Hi, Tom. Love your show.
Thank you.
You know, I was reading the paper the other day, and I'm so discouraged. It said that, you know, the president, you know, this guy hasn't touched a veto pen when his buddies were in power. Now he vetoes everything. And when the Democrats try and put legislation through, be it for the war or whatever else, the Republicans don't go along, and this was the quote, because they don't want to give Democrats victories for the war. And I'm saying, what do the Republican people who voted for those Republicans say? My God, is that what it's all about? Games?
They're not paying attention.
By and large,
the Republicans are just not, they're not, actually the average American voter is not paying attention. There's a very small percentage of American voters who actually are paying attention to the issues. And about 93% of all voters are voting at the end of the day, on election day, they're voting based on their feelings, not on details and not on facts.
So to me, it's as if they would have gone along with at least, maybe not all, but at least some of what the Democrats try to do, maybe there would be some kind of an end in sight. But because it's a game to them, they don't want to give them victories, the soldiers that die from this day forward, the blood is on their hands. How do these guys sleep at night? My God, and it's so discouraging.
Their layers of rationalization are a mile high, Sam. I mean, it's the bottom line. But you're right. I mean, Trent Lott has come out and bragged about the fact that they are going to obstruct any attempt by the Democrats to pass meaningful legislation, and then they're going to run against them as a do-nothing Congress, and it's working. And he's right. They're doing it, and it is working. And that's why I agree with Bernie Sanders that Harry Reid needs to stand up on his back two feet and say, enough already. You guys, you're going to filibuster something? Great. We'll have a filibuster. But, you're spot on. Let's see, 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number, and Len in New York. Hey, Len, what's up?
Hi, Tom. What was the name of that governor again who's in jail now?
Don Siegelman, Alabama.
You see, my argument, again, for the last time this year, is that if you were on WABC radio, more people would know about this. And I know you're a big union supporter. And unions, when they're unhappy, go out on strike. And I feel that Democrats should be going out on strike against – you have to pick a company first. And my first choice is Disney. I mean, I'm going down to Florida for the third time since I discovered that WABC carries all the right-wing radio. And I'm spending a few thousand dollars on vacation, but not at Disney. And if 50 million, 100 million Americans went along with that kind, you know, at least the voice started, coming like a tsunami, that we're not going to spend money there until
you're doing that because Disney owns ABC and ABC syndicates,
Well, in the morning, I mean, starting at 12,
several
right wing
shows,
then it's Hannity, and then this really poisonous, venomous guy, Mark Levin.
Yeah.
From 12.
you know, Len, I understand, and I don't disagree with your willingness to use the marketplace and boycott, for example, a company. I'll tell you, it cuts both ways. There are companies and individuals who will have nothing to do with companies who advertise on this station, on this network, on this show. It just cuts both ways. I think that it's far more important to be making positive statements than negative statements, because there's no way that we could get a critical threshold that's going to cause Disney to say, hey, wait a minute, all that money that Hannity's making us, we're going to throw it out the window.
What you should be doing is
contacting the people who are supporting the programming that you like. In other words, if you like this show, for example, or if you like other programs on this radio station, I think you're listening to WWRL, if you like that station, contact their sponsors and tell them that you will support them. I'm telling you, it's extremely rare that advertisers hear from listeners with positive messages. They hear negative messages all the time, and negative messages in many cases actually work against you. It's like somebody will call up an advertiser and they'll say, I just heard this on a Tom Hartman show, I can't believe you said that, or, you know, Limbaugh fill in the show, and they'll say that to the advertiser, I can't believe, and I'm not going to support you anymore. And what does the advertiser say? They say, oh, he's listening to the Tom Hartman show. Oh, he's listening to the Rush Limbaugh show.
Yeah, but Disney directly gets thousands of dollars from every patron that goes to their parks.
No, I understand that, and I agree with that. My point is that a pro-cot, or whatever you want to call it, a buy-cot, B-U-Y-cot, you know, in other words, supporting the good guys is 100 times more effective than trying to stop the bad guys. That's the bottom line of my point. And you know, Len, I salute you for having the courage of your convictions and for you know, boycotting what you think is wrong. But you'll be much more effective if you support what you think is right. 45 minutes past the hour.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
A special thanks to my producer, David Poole, to Louise Hartman, to Chris Rosen, Zachary Marsh, Lauren Kirchner, and Marcus Hillman at Air America, to Sue Nethercutt and the folks in our chat room, and Mike Toth, who does our audio archives on our website over at TomHartman.com, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for listening to our program. Thank you so much. The best and worst of the year. And perhaps, I'm not sure if this qualifies as best or worst. Maybe strangest would be the...
Naughty boy. Bad boy, a naughty boy, a nasty, bad, naughty boy.
Yeah, so I'll leave that one up to you. And then, of course, the famous conversation. We remixed this slightly, but this was originally on Alan Colmes' radio show, where he was interviewing Neil Horsley, the guy who runs the website where they show pictures of abortion doctors and their addresses, and when they get killed, he puts a red X through them.
You are known for your anti-abortion and anti-homosexual views. You had sex with animals?
Oh, when you grow up on a farm in Georgia, your first girlfriend is a mule.
I'm not so sure that is so.
You didn't grow up on a farm in Georgia, did you?
Are you suggesting that everybody who grows up on a farm in Georgia has a mule as a girlfriend?
I'm saying that it has historically been the case. You people are so far removed from the
reality. Look, I'll admit, Neil, I'm a city boy. I don't know a lot about growing up on a farm.
Well, hello, welcome to domestic life on the farm.
But I think for you to say,
welcome to domestic.
There are a lot of people listening to you, right, Neil. There are a lot of people listening to me right now who live on farms, are raising kids on farms, who grew up on farms, and I don't think they're dating Elsie right now. You know what I'm saying?
The fact of the matter is, don't know that in fact you experiment with anything that moves when you're growing up sexually, you're naive, and you know better than that. You know yourself. If it's warm and if it's damp and it vibrates, you might in fact have sex with it.
No, not me.
Yeah,
thank you.
Yeah,
no, thanks.
Oh, come on. You know, I've had sex with anything that would move.
All right.
If we had a warm watermelon out in the field, I might give it a name.
Hello, I'm Mr. Red.
Yeah, good old Neil Horsley. Dave in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program.
Wow, that was pretty sick.
Yeah, that's pretty straight.
Hey,
that guy, until his appearance on Alan Colm's show, is one of the major leaders of the anti-abortion movement in the United States.
Wow. Hey, thank you for taking my call. I've been waiting a while. I moved to the States in 1991, and I was very excited about coming here. And
from where? From Canada?
I grew up in the Panama Canal Zone.
Uh-huh. Okay.
And joined the Navy, and then when I got out of the Navy, I came to the States. So my parents are American, however. When I got here, I got a job, full medical, and everybody at the small business had a full medical. Within a year or two, they said, you know, give us $100 a month and we'll keep the medical. And then within a year or two of that, it was dropped. And now I have a small business with about 100 employees. I can't ever imagine even possibly paying for medical for my employees. What happened? I've never really understood why medical got so expensive.
What happened was that 30 years ago, in most states in the United States, it was a crime. It was a felony. It was against the law for a hospital or a health insurance company to operate on a for-profit basis. They all had to be not-for-profit corporations. So they weren't spinning off 10% of their or 20% of their revenue as dividends to their shareholders, and they weren't paying their CEOs in stock options and paychecks, you know, tens, hundreds of millions of dollars a year. In the case of William McGuire, $1.78 billion in compensation for the CEO of the second largest health insurance company in the United States. They weren't doing that. And as part of Reagan's deregulation mania and the whole Reaganism thing, they said, oh, well, we should let health insurance companies and hospitals become for-profit. And Bill Frist's daddy started buying up these little county nonprofit hospitals, flipping them for-profit, and he became one of the 50 richest men in America. He became worth about $5 billion by doing that, by literally squeezing the blood out of you and me and grandma in order to make a profit. And the health insurance business has now become one of the most profitable industries in the United States, and in some small part because of Billy Towson as well, the congressman from, as I recall, Louisiana, in the House of Representatives, who shepherded through Medicaid Part D with the thing that said that the government couldn't negotiate drug prices, so they have to pay full retail, so the pharmaceutical companies are making out like everybody's making out like a bandit except you and me.
Right. Well, that helps me a lot, and I think that if politicians maybe should frame that, I think on the you know, either side of the aisle, I've been really wrestling with my political awareness now that I've been in the States for a while. And what do you think of Ron Paul? Because one thing he said to me, or at least on TV, was that we're spending $1 trillion every year, not including our defense spending, just on open bases and treaties we have with all these foreign governments. What if we brought them all home? We could save $1 trillion.
No, it wouldn't be $1 trillion. The entire defense budget is about $500 billion, about $500 billion.
Right.
And I don't know what percentage of that has to do with overseas bases. It's probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 or 20%. But Ron Paul's point that we are behaving like an empire, but we're not taxing ourselves like an empire. We're not paying for it like an empire. He's right on that. As to his proposal that we do away with Social Security, we do away with Medicare, we allow all the health insurance industry to be entirely for profit, that we stop regulating businesses, that we stop having laws that say that the air must be clean or the water must be pure, I don't go along with that. You know, Ron Paul's a libertarian Republican, and he would just throw the doors of this country open to the predators among us, and that frankly would not be a good thing in my opinion.
I do find myself moving towards the libertarian side of things, but it's an exciting country, and I wish Americans realized just how great it is.
Yeah, I agree with you, Dave. Thank you very much for your call. We do live in an extraordinary country. It's an incredible gift that many generations of people who have fought and died for this country have given to us, and that we need to build and strengthen and hand off to our children. Coming up next week on the Tom Hartman program, Ben Cohen's going to be here about Iowa. Conservative Joseph Farah of WorldNet Daily and I are going to shake it up on Ron Paul. Senator Bernie Sanders is always taking your calls, plus the best of the rest of the news right here on the Tom Hartman program, your radio support group for We the People. And don't forget, my friends, democracy begins with you. Activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you again live on Wednesday.
Correct. This is the Tom Hartman Program. For exclusive audio archives and more information, visit TomHartmanRadio.com.